We'll travel today, one room at a time, on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Scott Fisher is back with us today, this time writing about Midwest B&Bs on Scribble.
Scott, good to have you back again with a brand new book. Not one room this time, but many, many rooms.
Many rooms, thank you.
Far more than you were able to take
care
of. Great
to be here.
Why don't you explain what you did and how this ended up to be a book?
Well, it actually started long ago when my grandfather and his four brothers used to get together and talk about their days living in southern Iowa when their grandfather ran a railroad hotel. And they would talk about, you know, the boom town, and that was big coal mining country and railroads and everything. And it sounded like Tom Sawyer to me. I just thought those stories were great. Well, you fast forward about 40 years or so, and my wife and I were on vacation, and she happened to mention that she'd always wanted to have a bed and breakfast. And so I said, well, my family was in the hotel business way back when. And she said, really? Can we stop and see that place on the way back? And we did. The place is a ghost town now, and the old hotel was in pretty sad shape. But while we were there, we were told about the twin to that building in the next county over. So we said, oh, why not drive over and take a look? And one thing led to another, and we ended up buying that place and running it as a bed and breakfast for 7 years.
What is a railroad hotel?
Well, I assume it's a hotel that's just next to a railroad.
Okay, but is it any different? Did it always run as a B&B?
It was always a local hotel, and a lot of the railroad workers would stay there.
Also. Oh, okay.
Apparently, there were two hotels in town. Our side of the tracks was the better side, and they got the engineers and conductors. The other side of the track got the rest of the crew and the section gangs and things. So.
Was there a junction there or something where people had to change? Or
there was way back when, apparently. There's a big water stop there. The Rock Island Railroad had bought some land and flooded it and put up a dam. And so a lot of trains would stop there in Allerton and take on water there.
Well, here's just a little interesting odd fact about the water stop. You remember, it wasn't Green Acres, but it was a program like that where three girls are up in the on the
Petticoat
tank.
Petticoat Junction.
Yeah, Petticoat Junction. And there's a big tube that puts the mm-hmm. water down. Do you know why that tube is there? Because the train didn't have to stop.
Oh.
The train could slow down and move very slowly. It's hard for a train to stop
so
and
it would
to start
follow
up.
Along with them.
And then the water would pass in all the way along for
wow.
for a couple hundred feet, and then the train would go. Hence the name Jerkwater Town.
Oh my gosh! Wow.
The train was jerking water. So I hadn't thought about the fact that railroad workers, which they had to be constantly at work on mm-hmm. railroads, would
right.
stop there too.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
did it always include then breakfast and?
I think so. It was a standard railroad
right.
town and hotel. They had large dining room where they would get three meals a day if they wanted to, and they'd have events on weekends. They'd have balls and dances, things like that. Banquets.
There had to be people living there.
At that time, there were both of those towns, both Allerton, where we lived, and Garden Grove, where my grandparents lived.
By the way, it's knowledge like that that gave Tweet his PhD.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Piled higher and deeper is what it stands for.
But no, both those towns at one time had thousands of people.
Right.
And I think when we were in Allerton, it was about 600. And Garden Grove six.
Wow, yeah.
No, not quite that small, but it was not much left
right,
there.
Right, right. Well, I mean, did you think before you bought it? I mean,
apparently not well enough.
Here's this town in South. Well, yeah, I know, but you actually had people staying there. And,
oh, yeah. Well,
and you,
it
had
was
very successful
well, and
crowds.
It was right on the Mormon Trail.
Yeah.
When the Mormons set off from Nauvoo, they went in several bands.
Right.
And Allerton is where those bands kind of came back together.
Right.
And that's where Brigham Young kind of took over.
Right.
And then from there they went to Garden Grove, and that's where they set up their first actual settlement.
Right.
For to get through the year. So we kind of assumed that, oh, the Mormon Trail, this is a historic trail, and there'll be people coming.
Okay.
And we did. Some Mormon buses that came through.
But you got interesting groups that I hadn't even thought about, you know, Ladies Study Club. And
Sure. And, oh, yeah. Yeah.
We and had, things like that.
But it was actually, it was kind of in the middle
actually,
of nowhere.
Actually, you know, the pictures, you did really document your stay there very well. The inside of the hotel is far fancier than I had expected.
It was, yeah. And the guy before us that had it, he's a retired chef, and he wanted to make a fine dining establishment between Kansas City and Des Moines. And he'd grown up in Allerton and moved back when he retired. And so he hired a decorator. And he said, I want it to look like the San Francisco hotels of the early 1900s. And she did a really fantastic job of the curtains and the furniture and the wallpaper and everything. So, it had been empty for 3 years
right.
when we got it. But at that time, the governor had been there a few times, and he did pull in a lot of people. He ran it as a restaurant, though.
Mm-hmm.
He did not
okay.
rent rooms out much.
But the rooms, too. In fact, last summer, my wife and I went up to Mason City, Iowa, simply to stay at the Frank Lloyd Wright Hotel, which is about the same size and, in fact, has the same feel, the parlor, the hallways and stuff and the furniture.
Mm-hmm.
So it really reminded me of which was a very fancy hotel and still is. It's been restored back to its original. Well, we'll talk about how the book came about, but why don't you read us two sections, one
okay.
from your experience, your and your wife's experience
okay.
running a hotel, and then your ancestors.
Okay. I'll just start out with the first chapter here to get us so that see how this kind of came about. So it starts out, my big mouth. I've always wanted to have a bed and breakfast, my wife Julie said as we packed up our hiking gear and golden retriever Ginger into the car for the trip home. I think it would be fun, you know, cooking great food for all kinds of people in a peaceful, quiet place. We were on our way home to northern Illinois from a vacation in Colorado during my summer break from teaching at a local college. Julie had never been to the Rocky Mountain National Park and was particularly impressed driving up the big Thompson River Canyon with all the quaint little bed and breakfasts, gift shops, and family motels. Then I uttered the reply that haunts me to this day. You know, my family was in the hospitality business down in southern Iowa a long time ago. They owned a railroad hotel and a bakery down there. Big mistake, I now know, a dumb one. Nothing else was said until later the day as we crossed the Iowa-Nebraska border eastbound on Interstate 80. Julie was looking at the map. Where's that place where your family had their hotel, she asked. Place called Garden Grove, I said. I'm sure it's a ghost town now, probably not even on the map. Hey, here it is, she pointed to the bottom page of the road atlas. Why don't we drive down and see if it's still there? Wouldn't you like to see it? Sure, I said. Why not? The second dumb thing I said that day. Garden Grove was even more of a ghost town than I had anticipated. Not much besides a main street, ball-shaped water tower, and a few buildings. There was a hand-painted mural on the edge of the last building declaring that we were traveling on the Mormon Trail. There it is, Julie pointed across the street at a red brick two-story structure. It was in rather sad shape, broken windows, sagging porch roof, the drive-through overhang, I think they call it a porte de cochere, was gone completely with only the brick piers remaining. However, it appeared that someone was working on it. There were two new air conditioning compressors along the west side and construction materials stacked on the front porch, but there was no one in sight. Let's take a look around, Julie said, already out of the car. As Ginger and I got out of the back, I gazed at the upper floor's empty windows. It reminded me of when Eleanor Lance gets her first glimpse of Hill House in Shirley Jackson's novel and later film, The Haunting. And whatever walked there walked alone.
Very good.
And it went on from there.
Yeah, that's okay. Take us to the second part.
Okay, there's two stories going on here, and my great great grandmother was the cook at that hotel in Garden Grove, and I was able to get some of the letters that she wrote to her brother who lived in Murray, Iowa, named Will, and her letters kind of describe their actions down there. So this first letter is as she's telling him that they're planning to actually do this. They had been living in Cherry, Illinois, running the company store for the mining company there. She says, "Dear Will, I am writing these few lines to let you know of our plans. It seems that we are destined to move once again, this time in your direction. Grandpa James has entered into a business agreement that shall involve all of us, including Charlie's sisters, Claude and Maud, sisters Chloe and Maud, their husbands and sons. We are leaving the mine company store in Cherry, Illinois, and relocating to Garden Grove, Decatur County, Iowa. Charlie says he thinks we will be within a two-hour buggy ride from you there in Murray. I do not recall ever having visited Garden Grove when we lived in Afton all those years ago when you and I first traveled to Iowa. Perhaps you and Nell and Theola may be able to visit on the occasional Sunday when weather permits. Grandpa James was at a horse racing track in Chicago and met a man named Stearns, who's a banker and investment man from Garden Grove and who also runs racehorses. He purchased some tack and carrots from James' wagon. After some conversation, Mr. Stearns asked if James would bring his family to Garden Grove to run his new hotel. There are many trains each day stopping at Garden Grove, and the hotel mainly serves salesmen and potential investors in the town. Mr. Stearns is in need of a complete staff and suggested that even the younger boys could make tip money running errands for guests. James says it's a very fancy hotel with two dining rooms and a large kitchen. Charlie's sisters Maud and Chloe and their husbands will be in charge of the hotel front desk, lobby and dining rooms, and guest room preparation, including laundry and upkeep. James asked if I would take charge of the kitchen and promised that I can have anything I need. Right now the hotel serves only breakfast and supper, but Mr. Stearns would like to expand to include special events. Charlie is finally going to have his own bakery in a building that Mr. Stearns owns next door to the hotel. Charlie will provide all the bread and baked goods for the hotel and prepare midday meals served in the bakery cafe area. There is living space for Charlie, myself, and the five boys in rooms above the bakery." And it's from my grandfather and his four brothers and their adventures from living above that bakery that the story started with me.
So you lasted there 7 years?
Yes.
And I guess from the reading from the book, pretty much broke even, right?
Yeah. When all was said and done, and yeah, about broke even, which I thought was pretty good for being out in the middle of nowhere.
And you sold to another unsuspecting person?
Yes. Yeah, we did. As far as I know, they're still in business.
Well, you make it sound like fun, but also a lot of work.
Oh, it was incredible.
You know, only the first year where you were down there, you took a leave of absence from your teaching job, but then you had to go back and teach on weekends, probably 5 hours down and
it was kind of a hike.
Yeah. And you did that for 6 years?
Yes.
So you lived there at the bed and breakfast?
Yes. They told us in town that we were the first people to actually live in the hotel before people had lived elsewhere in town. And the hotel had not been lived in except by guests. So
you couldn't find another house to live in?
Well, we thought it would be a good idea. So, you know, good ideas sometimes turn into not such good ideas. But Julie really enjoyed making the breakfasts and meeting the people. She's a good cook, fortunately. That's, you know, saved. I couldn't cook much, so I had to be the bottle washer and maintenance guy. I was the Mr. Green Jeans of the bed and breakfast.
So when did you decide there's a book here?
The book kind of came about 3 or 4 years ago. I started thinking I could put something together, but Julie wouldn't cooperate at that point. So she was not ready to revisit all those memories, especially of the first year. So I had to wait a little while before she was I started writing it and outlining it and putting together the old folks story, thinking, well, maybe it'll just be them. But as the grandchildren came along, And she mellowed somewhat about it. So, and I convinced her. I said, you know, if you could run a bed and breakfast for 7 years down in a place where it's not even on the way to anywhere and break even, then that's pretty doggone good. Think what you could do in a destination site like Galena or something, you know. So I think that made her feel a little better.
You better be careful saying things like that, because she may decide, well, let's do it in a more populated place.
I doubt it. I doubt it. Although when we left there, she did do interim innkeeping for a few years, where people would go on vacation and want someone to watch their bed and breakfast. And so she would go and stay there for a week or so. And she enjoyed that. But like I said, grandchildren came along, so that kind of put the end to that, too.
Yeah, but that's fascinating, the turns a life can take when you are willing to take a gamble.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a gamble, all right.
But it seemed to me, at the moment you made that decision, that's the most improbable thing I think a person could come up with.
Yeah, it was just one of those things that one thing just led to another. I mean, it was almost a year before we actually bought it and moved in. We hemmed and hawed and went back and forth and visited the town and talked to the people in the county. And it was just one of those things where it seemed like the right time.
Well, but, were there other people in the town at that time?
Yes, they had some businesses in Allerton, and they were really nice people, very helpful. And very supportive, so that was part of it too. I think the award for the most courage goes to our daughter Ashley, though, because she was going to be a senior in high school the year that we decided to go, and we lived in Rockford, Illinois, which she had a graduating class, I think, of about 600 and some, and she had to make the choice of moving with us down to a place where she'd have a graduating class of about 40. And quite a different lifestyle change. And we said, well, we'll make arrangements for you to stay your senior year with friends or relatives in the Rockford area, or come along, but it's up to you completely. And so we took her down with us a few times, and we looked, and in the end, she decided to go with us. And she dove right in, and she was part of the renovations. She chose one of the rooms that needed the most work. And so on the weekends, she's sanding and painting and helping with guests. And
And what a different experience high school from
right,
Rockford.
Right, exactly, yeah.
You quote one of the coaches saying, well, how do I get on the team? He said, you show up, you're on the
team. Yeah, so we'll give you a uniform. You may not be varsity, but you're on the team.
Right, yeah, and that's...
And she learned all about all those long bus rides, especially
right.
down in rural areas
right.
where they ride right. buses forever. And she played volleyball. Right. She ran track. She played softball. And she never would have done that in Rockford. That just would have been too many kids to compete with.
Well, you have taken a spot in South Central Iowa and turned it into a really interesting book. I mean, it is full of... did you take notes as you went along, or is this...
Somewhat,
you just
yeah.
went back and thought?
Well, Julie had, in each room, she put little notebooks in each room for guests to make comments. And when we left, we took those with us. So I was able to look through those to kind of remind myself of some of the events and things. But the people... In the book, we go through all the terrible things that happened right away. The boiler failed and it was rusted out, and the basement was just full of spoiled food, and we had to clean that out. And the sewer, we had to replace that. We had to tear down a building next door that we didn't even know we owned. And just all those things. And I didn't have to take notes to remember those at all. So, yeah, it was like a bad Tom Hanks movie. I mean, it was...
Why did you not use that other building when you found out you owned it?
Oh, well, there was a tree growing up through the middle of it, one thing. It was beyond repair. But it was interesting. People in town found out we were going to tear it down, and all of a sudden, it was probably one of the most historic buildings in town anybody had ever seen.
Yeah, right.
And they were really concerned, and we finally just said, well, it's got to go, because they wouldn't let us have insurance unless we either fixed it up or tore it down. And there was no fix-up to that poor little building.
I would think maybe a Spanish motif, you know, with the tree going up through the middle right. And then the rooms arranged around, you know, just
well,
kind of open it up.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. Maybe that would have been a possibility. And it was connected to the next block. It wasn't even connected to our building. Uh-huh. So tearing it down was really kind of tricky because it was attached to the next door lady's staircase, and she was concerned. But we found a really good guy that came in, and his crew had it down in a day. And just it was like watching an orchestra, watching them use their equipment like musical instruments, and just pulling that building down and carrying it away. So yeah, we lucked out as far as finding people that.
You know, when they decided to take a building down on Second Avenue here in Rock Island, they started to demolish it, and they discovered that those buildings kind of shared the same walls. That the walls were not built so just to support that one building. They kind of depended on one another. And so that gave them some real problems.
Yeah, that's you kind of need an engineer to come in and advise.
One of the things I've been dying to ask you is, as far as your guests are concerned, the 80-20 rule. I have a friend who says that 80-20 is the thing that applies to any group activity. You know, you get a group together, 80% of the people or 20% of the people will do 80% of the work, right? Or you go to a poetry reading and 80% of the people will like it, but 20% won't. Or 20% of the people will like it, but 80% won't. That's roughly how it works mm-hmm. down. You must have had some ornery guests too, right?
Yeah, I guess 80-20 about works. You know, 80% were very complimentary. They had a good time. We had a lot of repeat customers that came back. And 20%, you know, there were those that smoked in their rooms yeah. and they weren't supposed to, or would make outlandish requests. But that was not the rule. It was 80, maybe even 90% were very,
okay, right.
very good people to come and stay and easy to get along with. We had deer hunters during deer hunting season. Mm. After a few years, we decided that winters were pretty sparse. And the deer hunters were the same thing. Most of the deer hunters that came were very polite and followed Julie's rules. But every now and then, we had one man who was just ornery. He was even ornery. He brought his wife with him, and he was even ornery to her. And his fellow hunters. And a couple of times I asked Julie, I said, would you like me to have a talk with him? And Julie says, nope, don't say a word. By the time he leaves, he's going to be my best friend. And she gave him extra helpings of pie.
Right, right.
And by the end, yeah, he was her best friend. So it was amazing to watch. I would have tossed him out about the second right. day.
Did you ever have to toss anybody out?
No, never. A few times, very rarely. We just had to remind people that there were other guests and some of their behavior wasn't quite what it should be. But that was very, very rare. So we were kind of lucky like that.
Yeah, my dad was part owner of the Stockyards Hotel on the south side of Memphis, which was really nothing. But he was a retired police sergeant. They called him Colonel Lauder. Actually, back in that time, the Memphis Police Department was into bootlegging. So Colonel Lauder had a little money. And he and Dad threw together what they had. Got the hotel, and I had $125. And they said, we'll stay until we run out. And they were there for years.
Wow.
Yeah, mule traders. They turned out to be a pretty dependable lot.
Wow.
But the hotel was not that often used, mostly the restaurant
mm-hmm.
and the poker games in the back, mm-hmm. which eventually got them busted.
Well, that was the interesting part about Garden Grove and the young boys. They were into all kinds of shenanigans. And like I said, hearing them talk and reminiscing at these family reunions, it was like Tom Sawyer to me. I mean, it was just like, wow, what a life that was for those boys to, you know, be in a boom town like that with all the gambling going on and some of those things.
Yeah, it's a small town, big town, you know, they're different stories. Big towns, in those days at least, used to be made up of discrete neighborhoods where you knew everybody. Now, you don't know anybody no matter where you live. And it's it's an interesting change in life. But what's the size of the town now?
I don't think it's changed much. It's probably gone down a little bit. I would guess 500-600 people altogether are in there. Garden Grove, I would guess realistically maybe 100. There are a few. There are no businesses left there, but there are still people that have
no grocery houses store.
There. No. Nope. There was a cafe there, a restaurant that we go to sometimes, but while we were there, they closed.
Okay.
So that was the last of the businesses that Garden Grove
so
had.
So the B, yeah, okay.
There were people that would come and go with the old Lady Amber that would try to, they'd buy it, they'd fix it up with plans, but then they would know, stop and go broke. So.
Yeah. My wife wanted me to ask you what the mystique of a B&B is, because she's a great reader of mysteries, and currently we're both reading Kate Kingsbury mysteries, and like 80% of the mysteries, they take place in B&Bs.
Wow.
You know, the sleuth owns a B&B, or her husband does, and that's on television, too.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of B&B.
I don't know. Gosh, you know, that's one of the things I wish we would have had a ghost. That would have really helped. I tried to, you know, and every now and then, sometimes somebody who had worked there for the previous guy or lived there or who had visited their old, you know, relatives that lived there would say, you know, there's a ghost here. And I go, oh, cool. Tell me all about it. Well, eventually it would turn out to be something very explainable. But I was hoping for a ghost. That would have really helped, but we never did.
So how long did it take you to actually write the book once you?
Once I started in on it, it took probably about a year to get it to where I was happy with it.
Do you have a regular writing schedule or?
Yeah, usually in the mornings. Now that I'm retired from full-time teaching and I don't do as much freelance writing as I did, so usually I get up and Julie works at Genesis and we live pretty close, so the dog and I escort her to Genesis and then we walk back and I usually get some writing time done before noon.
Are you working on another book?
I've got a few different things going on right now. I haven't really settled on anything for sure, but
your own experience?
No, I'm going to try some fiction this time.
Okay,
I've never done any. I've said some short fiction, but I've never done a novel. And I think every writer has this idea that they're going to write the great American novel.
Right.
So I got that in mind that maybe that'll be my next thing, but I'm not really
Scott,
quite
before,
sure.
Before we run out of time, how do we get hold of this book? One room at a time.
Well, you can get it on Amazon.com if you want to do that, or the Book Rack in Davenport over on Elmore carries it. So those are the two
easiest ways. Okay, do they carry your other books?
They carry my other books as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you made a nice start in writing, and why stop now?
Why stop? Yeah. it's fun. I just enjoy it.
Well, but fiction may be an interesting change for you.
It will. I'm sure it will. So
might it take place in a B&B?
I doubt it. I doubt it.
Well, Scott Fisher has been our guest today. He is the author of a new book, One Room at a Time. And thank you very much, Scott. We enjoyed talking to you.
And thank you.
I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. We'll be back next week at this same spot, and we hope you will too for the next edition of Scribble.